Ag State of Mind, Episode 3.
Welcome to Ag State of Mind, a podcast that examines the stresses affecting producers of agriculture and how to alleviate these stresses and improve farmers' lives. In this podcast, we discuss openly the mental health crisis that is occurring in the agricultural community and what we can do to help turn it around. Now here's your host, Jason Meadows.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Ag State of Mind. I'm your host, Jason Meadows. Today is a special day on the program for me. I get to talk to a friend, a neighbor, and a mentor of mine. Kerry Portell is a partially disabled rancher and also a national speaker who goes around and speaks to whoever wants to hear her story. She has an incredible story. In 2010, Kerry was severely injured in an auto accident. She was hit head-on by a drunk driver. So we talked to her a little bit about that, about her road to recovery and how it changed her life and how being involved in agriculture as both a producer and a speaker has helped her grow. As I mentioned, Kerry is a close friend of mine, and she's been a huge influence on the work I've done so far, and also the work I hope to do going forward. She is a friend and an incredibly inspiring human. I'm glad to know her. She lives just down the road from me, so I'll go on probably say that she'll be, other than maybe if I decide to have my wife on someday, she'll be the closest in proximity guest to me on the show. So it's pretty exciting for me. So I hope you all enjoy our conversation today and hope you can take something from it.
Welcome to the show, Kerry.
Thank you.
So first, what I want to do, I know there's several people who are familiar with your story, familiar with what you've been through, but something I want to talk about is who was Kerry before the accident? Who was Kerry before your life changed, for, I guess, a lack of a better word?
Yeah. Oh, man, I thought about her before. That car crash is definitely a big niche in my timeline. So there is pre-Kerry and then there's post-Kerry. I think about before all this happened, I honestly remember over and over and over again asking God to show me a way to slow down. Because I was going 90 to nothing. I had, you know, four young kids. I had just closed my photography studio and went back to the medical field so that I could have a more routine work schedule. And I just could not figure out how to slow down. And that is my natural personality. I grew up with two parents who did the same thing, and I guess I just inherited that. I like work, but I knew that I needed to slow down. And
is that right?
Yeah, x-ray tech. I went back to school that year before my car crash as well for MRI. So when I went back to work, I did both. I did x-ray and MRI in a small clinic in Rolla.
That's right. I remember that now. So much has happened since then, and I forgot that you were doing that. So, I kind of remember you doing that a little bit, but like I said, there's so much has changed that, you probably – feel like that was a different person as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it seems like a lifetime ago, but yet whenever I think about certain things, boy, it can take me right back to, being right in the moment.
Right in the moment, as in being Kerry before the crash?
I guess during my recovery, certain memories, I can be right back there in an instant.
Right. Okay. So, obviously, we've all, or not all of us have heard it, but a lot of us have heard the story, but I'd still like for you to take the opportunity to tell us and share with us here what happened, what changed you, what was it that was the turning point for you?
The turning point for me was December 29th, 2010, so it's coming up on 9 years, that I was coming home from that x-ray job, and I needed to go teach a Zumba class in Cuba, and our four kids were all home together, and December 29th is Christmas vacation. And you having four children pretty close in age, you realize that just means there's going to be utter chaos and irritability and fighting between siblings. So I told my two middle children, I'm like, hey, you guys need to come with me to, you know, kind of split up the chaos. And sometimes they needed babysitters, you know, at Zumba. So I said, you two come with me and you know, just in case. And then 8 minutes down the road, we were in a four-vehicle car crash hit by a drunk driver.
Wow. Tell me, how many kids were with you again?
Our two middle kids were with me.
Two middle kids were with
me. The oldest and the younger.
Okay. And how old are they?
They were 10 and 12.
10 and 12.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when they think about the car crash, like in their mind, they remember it as 10 and 12-year-olds. So I don't know if that ever changes.
Right. Huh. So what do you mean you don't know if that ever changes for them? Do they see it as they are still children? Are they not able to see it from their more closer to adult point of view? You know, that was 9 years ago, you know, and they're both almost adults.
Yeah. Right. I think maybe I used the wrong word. Maybe how they feel about it emotionally. Emotionally, when those memories comes up, it's always going to feel the way it was when they experienced it as 12-year-olds. I think as they get older, they do see things a little more clearly. You know, at that young of an age, you just don't quite understand the full capacity of how close we were, you know, to not being on this earth anymore.
Right.
But just emotionally, like their hearts just, they just seize up whenever they talk about it.
So do you have any real recollection of the crash itself?
I was knocked out on impact.
Okay.
Oh, the last thing that I can remember was I was staring straight into his headlights. And I mean, my memory is I screamed at the top of my lungs and I said, "Oh God." And, the girls remember me screaming as well. And that was the last thing that I can remember is look into his headlights. I screamed and I 100% remember like accepting that I was not going to make it and begging that my girls would be saved, would be spared.
Wow. That's, you know, kind of a, I guess, life before your eyes type of moment.
Yeah. I mean, they say your life left before your eyes, but like, I didn't have time for that. I was
sure,
like,
right. Yeah,
what can we do about it?
Yeah.
Like I had to get one accept. And then I was like, what can we do about it? And then I was like, this is going to happen and please save my girls.
Yeah. You, mom kind of kicked in there really, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like in that moment, there's no selfish tendency whatsoever. It's like, I guess you do that trading thing. Hey, if this is going to happen, can you take me? Just leave my kids.
If it's one or the other, of course, you know, I think,
yeah,
you know, given the situation, obviously nobody wants to be in that situation, but I think given the situation, you or your kids, obviously you want it to be you. So, I think any parent can kind of see it.
Yeah.
Point of view. So what is the next thing you remember? What do you remember? Do you remember them pulling you out of the crash? Do you remember waking up in the hospital? What is it? You saw headlights and then what?
Yeah. I remember the girls yelling at me saying just over and over and over again, "Mom, please wake up. Please wake up. Mom, are you okay?" And I remember kind of waking up going, what the heck? What is going on? And then like in that very next instant, it was like, oh my gosh, this happened. And I remember, this is so weird, very specifically, I was looking out my driver's side window and I asked myself, you know, like everything's in your head. I'm like, why is there grass like right at the edge of my window? I'm like, that's kind of weird. And it's very odd how your mind's working, you know, in that situation. And later I realized we had actually ended up turned around backwards and I was right beside the railroad tracks that were built up, you know, so that's why the grass was that high. And my very next question was, why can I only see in black and white?
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, my color vision had left whenever I looked to my left side, but when I looked to my right, I couldn't see anything. So my right side of my brain, I guess, wasn't working correctly. I couldn't see out of my right eye, and I could only see black and white out of my left. And then my very next thought was, okay, girls, are you okay? And I just kept telling them, like, you got to calm down, call 911. And when they got done with the 911 call, I said, okay, you need to call Dad. And then after that, I really don't remember hardly anything. During the whole extrication part, I don't remember the girls getting taken out at all. I do remember the paramedic that was beside me because he just kept talking to me the whole time. For some reason, I always remember him calling me baby. He's like, baby, you got to hang on. And, you know, why those weird moments stick in your head is crazy.
But, you know, I mean, you know, it's probably kind of a testament to what, you know, he was able to do. You know, who knows if he wasn't comforting, you know, talking to you in a comforting way, you know, how much harder it would have been. I mean, already it was hard enough. And, you know, it's kind of a testament to.
Yeah.
Do you have a relationship with that guy, that EMT or paramedic? Do you know him?
I don't know him. Surprisingly, I don't, because I think I knew everyone else who was on the scene. For a long time, I thought this guy must have been an angel or something, because I could not find him. Nobody knew who he was. And I finally got a hold of someone, and I was like, you have to find out who this person is, because right now my mind's like saying this isn't a real person. And they did. They found out who the person was, and he had actually moved away, I think, to Fenton. So then we were able to get into contact, and I was able to tell him personally what a difference he made in, I think, how I reacted during that, just because he was very firm with what he needed me to do. And I think, you know, he's like that because he needed to get through that fog, that shock that was in my head. But yet he was, you know, he was that compassion and I'm here for you. I'm going to take care for you, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Wow. Wow. Obviously it's a terrible thing that you went through, but you know, it sounds like you had all the right people there at the right time. So that kind of segues into what I want to talk about next. And it's to talk about, first of all, what injuries did you come away with, and what was your recovery process? What did that look like? What was involved in that?
I had three injuries that were severe. I mean, the others were, you know, they healed with time and that kind of stuff. But the three that have really caused me the most fits and has, I hate saying it, but it has partially disabled me, because I don't think of myself as being partially disabled, but yet, like, working in the medical field, I know that I am. But my both of my lower legs were crushed and my pelvis was broken. And it took me the next 4 years before my surgeon, I had two surgeons, to say, you know, Carrie, this is it. You know, there's really nothing more that we can do. This is, you know, you recover to the best of your ability. Come back, you know, only if things start to deteriorate. And I did. I went back twice. I had two more surgeries. After that, I think the fifth and sixth year, I each had one. It felt like forever, you know. And, you know, my pre-carry before the car crash, my mind was still wanting to be busy and say that I could do things, and I couldn't do any of that for 4 years. I mean, that's forever to be asked to say, you know, can you sit and be patient and just heal? But for 4 years.
To see what you've done now, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but to think of you in that capacity and having to sit and go through these surgeries after surgeries for, you know, like you said, 4 years is, you know, for somebody who knows you personally, like I do, it's hard to even imagine you like that now, because of the way that you have recovered. And I think that's a testament to you as an individual and as your as your strength, your will to do something and make a difference. Because I think when somebody goes through something like you did, it can go one of two ways. And the first way, and I think I don't want to say the most common, but the way most people think of it is, you know, you had something bad happen to you and you're just going to throw in the towel. You know, I got dealt a bad hand and I'm going to have to just deal with it. And, you know, this is just the life, the way life is. But that wasn't you. You went the other way. You refused to be a victim. And I just can't tell you how much that means to me, to people around you, and even people who don't know you, just people who you reach and who you influence, to know that, you know, you had a bad thing happen to you and you made the absolute best out of it. So I kind of want to talk about that and what kept you going? What kept you, you know, wanting to be the person you've become now?
I appreciate that assessment very much. I agree 100% that a lot of time when something like this happens, people like to take the road of being angry and bitter and blame and the whole why me type attitude. And, you know, I remember waking up in the hospital, and at least I don't remember it. I never had a single thought like that. And, you know, I make a joke of, you know, maybe it was the Dilaudid that made me wake up so happy and, you know, but a lot of it, I mean, I remember there when my surgeon came in, and I specifically remember him standing at the end of my hospital bed, and my husband was beside me, and he was giving this prognosis that, you know, in no better words, it just kind of sucked. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking, okay, I hear what you're saying, but can you at least let me try? And that was my trauma surgeon, and he was phenomenal. He's like, absolutely. He's like, you try as hard as you want to. Just let's not, you know, injure yourself any further. And I think for me, I looked at my four kids and I thought, I cannot let them down, because if I give up, then that gives them, I was afraid in their minds later as they grew up, that would give them permission to give up on their life as well. And I thought, well, if I handle this the right way, then that means everybody around me will hopefully handle it the right way. And those are very conscious thoughts. Like, I cannot tell you how much the emotional side of this recovery was just as hard as physically recovering.
Yeah, that's something I want to talk about a little bit, because obviously this is a podcast that deals with mental health. And you say you didn't have any thoughts of becoming a victim like we talked about, but I mean, you had to struggle with doubt, right? I mean, you had to want to give up at some point, right?
Yeah. There were certain times, like I think it was around 5 to 6 months after, you know, after my car crash, and I was still in my living room. Like, I hadn't been able to move back in my bedroom yet.
Right.
And the pain was, yeah, still so atrocious that I remember thinking, you know, maybe it would just be easier if I didn't try to walk, because that was my whole goal, was I want to walk again. They're telling me I'm probably not going to be able to do this, but that was my end goal. And gosh dang it, it was hard. I mean, I had nothing to do, absolutely nothing to do all day, because it hurt so bad to even move. But your mind is still living like the way that you used to.
Yeah.
And it just drives you crazy.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't imagine. I honestly, I mean, the pain and the injuries that you went through were bad enough. You know, no one should ever have to experience that. But to have a working mind, but I don't know how to say it at the time, a broken body. I honestly don't know how I could handle it in that situation. And I guess just a testament to your willpower. I think, you know, and I think you'll agree with this, that to someone looking out on the outside looking in like I am, it's, you know, we see how hard it would be. But you in the moment, I'm sure you just did it. You just got through it, however you got through it, just to see the next day. Is that fair? Is that a fair way that you did it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say for the first 3 months, I couldn't even take it day by day. I was more of, let's get through the next 2 hours. And that's how slow it was. That's how, like, hard of a, I guess, path that it was. And, I mean, I talked to myself way too much, and I don't even think I had control over it. I mean, I was asking so many questions, and it was more like, you know, am I going to get through this? And I always ask myself, you know, am I going to be okay? And I remember thinking, I don't even know what that means, because I don't know if it means physically, mentally, or emotionally. I'm like, am I going to be okay if I never walk again? Will I be okay with that? And a big part of it, I kept wondering, you know, am I ever going to heal from this? And that was the mentally emotional part. Because, I mean, it messes with your mind when you have that much time and you really, really get to know yourself. If you dig down and you decide, hey, I'm not going to push all this away. I'm going to go through that messy muck of a, you know, the middle part of your journey. And there were some long talks with my husband. I mean, long talks. And unfortunately we had some of them two and three times, because I didn't remember them the first time.
So I do want to talk about Greg, because I've known Greg for most of my life, your husband. And I can tell you, there were times where we met at the end of the road, and for anybody listening, during this time when Carrie was going through this, my wife had just been given birth to twins, and my life was a whirlwind of a different sort. I wasn't sleeping. I was losing my mind in a different way. But I remember seeing Greg at the end of our driveway. I talk about this in the introduction, that Carrie will probably be on this show the guest that is the geographically closest to me, as she lives about, our driveways are less than 2 miles apart, so we meet each other on the road often. But we had a lot of talks on the end of the driveway with Greg and I, you know, about how you were doing. And, you know, I could see, you know, obviously you were suffering, but I could see the pain in his eyes as well. And, you know, I'm a little older and a little wiser now than I was back then, and I can kind of see myself through his eyes. And, you know, so what was he like during that? What was, how important was he and his emotional and, I guess, even physical support to you during that time?
Yeah, he was 100% all of those, because for a long time, months, physically, he had to help me get dressed, bathe, you know, all of that kind of stuff. He had to come home and he had to clean all of my wounds. And I had external fixators on my lower legs for a long time, you know, and he had to clean those every single night, and he had to give me shots so I wouldn't get blood clots. And I think he slept beside me on the couch for 3 months. And I remember, I mean, I really never slept. So I would stare at him from the hospital bed in my living room, at him on the couch. And I remember thinking, he is so uncomfortable right now, but he is scared to death to leave my side. I've got to let him, you know, go back to our bedroom and be able to get a decent night's sleep. But even at 3 months, I was still having to take medication in the middle of the night. So he was setting his alarm to make sure that I would remember to take it, because I may have seemed like I was there mentally a lot of time. You know, I would hold on conversations, but being on so much medicine, I would lose my thought from one second to the next.
Of course. Yeah.
Yep. But he was my coach. That's the perfect way to put it. That is his natural born ability, is to coach people. And he did not hesitate with this situation. He picked right up where he needed to, and he became the mom, the dad, the cook. He took care of the farm. He became my caretaker. And I could see, like you said, the sorrow, the stress, the pain in his face. And, you know, I can talk about me and be okay now, but when I talk about Greg or our kids, like, it hurts my heart. That's probably the biggest thing about this whole circumstance is I can handle me, but when I think about what my family had to go through and suffer and watch their mom for 4 years just not be the mom that they deserved, it literally tears my heart out of my chest.
I'm sorry to bring up any negative emotions, but I'm really happy that you guys got to the other side of it. And, you know, our community, even our little pseudo neighborhood out here, is better for it. And, I'm thankful for your recovery. And I want to ask, at what point did you realize that it was going to be, like you said, quote unquote, okay? Because, I mean, you'll live with this till the day you die, I'm sure. But
yeah,
to know that, you know, things were going to be someday semi-normal.
I specifically remembered it. It was almost exactly a year, maybe a little bit past. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, the stages of grief after, like, you lose someone that you care about, even though we all made it, it's almost like I still went through that whole grieving process. And it was a year, and, like, something lifted from my heart. And I remember just being able to breathe. And I knew 100%. I'm like, no matter what happens with me physically, like, I know I am going to be okay. This is all going to come out all right, no matter what happens, whether I can walk again or whatever. It's going to be okay.
And was life easier for you after that? I mean, obviously you still had surgeries and you still have, but was it just, you said you just probably walked a little bit lighter. You just, you know, I mean, like you said, you just had a little bit of a burden lifted. Was that right?
Right. Yeah. Physically, it wasn't really, I mean, it was a little bit better that getting into that second year, but it was almost like I had gone through an acceptance phase, and I had gone through many acceptance phases, you know, with each surgery and, you know, as the months would go by. And I think I just was able to stop asking so many questions, but, you know, like, mostly it's, you know, am I going to be okay? It's like, I got that answered. So then after that, everything else was, okay, this is definitely still going to be difficult, but I think I can handle this now, and I don't have to lean so much on my husband, because I leaned on him a lot. And we had a phenomenal support system around this. I mean, I cannot stroke the ego of the communities around us enough to say how much we needed that support, just to know that they were there. I mean, it was, you know, when I finally got to start going out, it was every time they went to the grocery store, or, you know, just the text or the emails just say out of the blue, you know what, I'm still thinking about you. Because it was, I mean, my recovery was so long. It's like, hey, you should be better now. And I wasn't.
Yeah.
So to have that support that entire time, just it was amazing.
Yeah. I wrote a blog post about that a few weeks ago, where it talks about how I remember the county fair. I remember, you know, them having the auction, the benefit for you, and then Olivia's hog, and it still its name still being on the record board. Well, actually, I don't think it is anymore, but it was up there for a long time. Set the record. I can't remember. Yeah, I can't remember what it was, but it was several, probably at least a dozen dollars over market price. And I just, you know,
right.
when you come when you grow up and when you are in a community where agriculture, where farming, where ranching is such a big part of it, I think there's a support system there that is unparalleled in the rest of the world. Would you agree?
I do agree. And when I go to my speaking events, when I speak to an ag group, it is my favorite because I can feel it. Like as soon as I walk into the room, I'm like, these are my people. I can feel the community within them.
Yeah. And especially when it happens to one of their own, you know, like was the situation for you, you know, I mean, it's a circle the wagons type thing. And, you know, it's all, you know, whatever cliche you want to use, all hands on deck, you know, everybody is there to support you. And, you know, and that's an incredible feeling. It's an incredible feeling to just even live around that.
Absolutely. And be a part of that, because since ours happened, you know, there's been several other situations in our community where people then have, you know, needed our support. And any way we can ever pay it forward, you know, back to that community, every chance that we get, we do that.
Yeah, because you see firsthand what that support's like.
100%.
So I want to talk about, because, you know, this is an ag podcast. We dealt with it in just a little bit, but I want to talk about your work with MoAgrability and what that's done for you and what you've been able to do in that capacity.
Yeah, it's that has been like the best introduction I have ever had was to Missouri AgriAbility. That was in 2014, I believe, the end of 2014. It was evident that I was not ever going to be able to go back to a normal job anymore. So I had asked my husband, you know, what do you think about me working the farm? Because there was nothing else I could do. And it was there. It was what we had. And my physical therapist, at one point, I remember him saying, he's like, you know, why are you coming in here anymore? He's like, you own a farm. He's like, you can do all your physical therapy on your own farm and then just check in with me every once in a while. Well, you know, that part was great, but I was having difficulty with my mindset of Carrie before the car crash and now Carrie with partial disabilities. And I couldn't figure out how to do certain chores with my new body. Mm-hmm. And I was having a lot of frustration because I am that person. Like I said, I love work. And I had not had any accomplishments, you know, besides, yeah, I do remember being very excited when I finally got to start, like, taking care of the house and doing laundry again. I mean, I truly was very excited. And, like, that was gone in a flash. I was, like, done with that. Like, this is boring. So being able to have, a purpose again, and I felt a lot like, hey, I want to be able to contribute and have, I guess, that personal satisfaction that, hey, I am able to do something. But it was just at the point where I was super frustrated because I can only take 3,000 steps a day at this point, and I have to make those. So I can't take them all in a row. Otherwise, I'm out really fast. And the other thing was energy. I mean, I was in so much pain, and then, you know, trying to do farm work at the same time, I didn't have very much energy. And of course, you know, my husband's main concern, you know, with working on a cattle farm was safety, because can't run, can't dodge, jump, you know, anything like that. So we're both pretty stubborn. And I was like, I have to do something, you know, and he's like, you're going to do it anyway. So just be careful, think about things. But I could not get to the point that I wanted to. And it's probably just me being, you know, I just wanted to keep reaching for more and more and more and not wanting to accept that, hey, this is all I'm going to be able to do. And just by chance, I had actually went to a women's ag conference, and a rep sat beside me, and she slid this card across the table. She said, "You have got to talk to these people. They will help you. I promise you." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Let's do it." And then got in touch with Karen Funkenbusch from Missouri AgriAbility. Mm-hmm. And she's a little spitfire, and we have become great friends. And from that experience and what she and the organization has done for me, I cannot stop advocating for them. I never will, because it's made me be able to farm at the level that I am today.
So, you talk more in detail about this, I think, in a few other abilities, but how specifically were they able to help you?
The very first thing that she ever did was she taught me new creative ways to use body mechanics. I wanted to do things the way that I used to, because I thought, you know you're not strong at that point, but your mind thinks you can still do things the way you used to. And, she's like, "You can't lift from the ground anymore. We need to build these tables so you can pull bags of mineral off at waist level." Things like that should be, it's almost like common sense, but yet when you're in the middle of the situation.
Probably. I mean, things just people don't even think about, you know. And you have
right, you don't think about it, you just do it.
Right, right. So it was a lot of kind of like ergonomic work, I guess. Is that the proper term?
Yes, yeah. She loves the word ergonomics, and she'll tell you she loves to teach that. So that was the very first thing that they said. And she's so funny, because she's like, "Okay, show me how you do things normally." And I had to take her through, you know, how I did my chores. And she's also very straightforward and blunt. And she just looks at me and she's like, "Carrie, why are you doing it that way?" And I just stared at her and I'm like, "I know that this isn't working. I just cannot figure out something better." And with AgriAbility, it's like their mindset is that they're always working, I guess, with that mindset. So, I mean, just right then she just rattled off a bunch of stuff and she's like, "Well, you need to do this, this, and this." And you just stare at her and you're like, "Duh.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't I think of that?"
And so it seems like the best solution is the simplest. And, I think a lot, people with normally functioning bodies, they just get into a routine of doing things a certain way and they don't even think about it. You know, the old kind of saying goes, "We do it that way because dad did it that way." For anything. I think that kind of goes just back to that, you just did it because that's the way you did it. And you didn't, until somebody actually came in and evaluated you and told you, "Hey, why don't you do it this way?" Maybe we should all be so fortunate to have somebody tell us how wrong we're doing stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, you definitely have to be open-minded.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say the other major thing that they did for me was my problems with steps and energy. Immediately, she's like, "You need a Polaris Ranger and you need a cake feeder on the back."
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea really how one of those worked. I'd never dealt with a cake feeder before. And I remember at the end of the first week that I used it, I called her and I said, "Karen, you are not going to believe how I feel." I said, it just took it the question of, I guess, all three things, how many steps I can use, the energy, and the safety, because I didn't ever have to get out of the Ranger using that cake feeder. I just ran by the bunks and left that grain out and I didn't use any steps. I barely used any energy. And then I wasn't out there pouring bags of feed in between, these cows or young heifers who were, trying to bump into me.
So is that, that's what you're feeding mostly is you guys, I know from talking to you guys that you guys do AI a lot of heifers. And that's mostly what you're dealing with around the house. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. We keep I would probably say up to 18 to 20 heifers back each year. And I keep an eye on them, you know, every single day. So I, you know, they're my projects. I raise them and just make sure that they're really taken care of. And then we have, you know, a few older cows that we keep on the property as well. But yeah, getting out there and you know, this past year in Missouri, like the ground never solidified because of rain.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You know? I mean, it was awful.
Stop.
Oh, it was so awful.
Yeah.
Like I've been around, I mean, I'm not old. I'm 35, but I've been around cattle my entire life. And I do not remember a winter like this one in Missouri where it was just pure slop. I mean, what, you can't even call it mud what we had. I mean, it was just like, it was like mud soup. I mean, it was terrible.
That's exactly what I told my husband. It was even to get out a gate one time and I looked down and I took a picture and I sent it to my husband. I said, I am standing in mud soup right now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a completely unsafe situation for me to be in around cattle. So having that ranger and being able to go through that, it allowed me to be able to feed and not have to have my husband come home after dark, you know, trying to do that himself.
So, people don't know, Greg has a town job. Right, he works for Wallace Lubricants, correct?
Correct.
So he's away from the place on a semi-regular basis. Is that a safe assessment to say?
Yep, correct. He tells me I can't do any farm work on the weekends. One, so that I can rest, and two, so that he can do something. Because he loves it. I mean, he wishes he could do it full time.
Right, yes, so do I. One thing I want to talk about this in your selection of your heifers. How, with what you've got going on, how big of a, how much do you place on disposition in those cattle?
Quite a bit. We really try to breed for great temperament, especially because I'm the one who's working with them most of the time. I mean, we go through every year, and, you know, and there's a lot of conflict, I guess, between, you know, farmers saying, hey, you shouldn't keep your own, you know, stock back. We actually love it because we like the quality that we are breeding, and we know almost instantly now how they're going to come out when they're born because we've done it enough years that we have bred, you know, to the right bulls, we've got the right combination to know that, hey, these are going to be really good quality, not only in beef production, but just being able to handle them. Because with me working with those heifers, especially every day, when it's time to get them up to work, you know, and get into the cattle chute, I promise you, all I have to do is open the gate and take a bucket of feed, and they know exactly where to go. And most of the time, you know, as long as something weird and freaky doesn't happen, it's so simple. They just go right in. And that's a testament to, you know, one, how you breed, and then working with them every day as well.
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, we should all select that, be that strict in our selection on disposition for our cow herd. Again, we're talking to Carrie Portell. She's classified as a disabled farmer, but you would never know it if just to see her in action. And we're running a little short on time here, Carrie, but I want to give you the opportunity to speak to somebody who is struggling, whether it be with something mentally, something physically. What would you tell someone who has just experienced something traumatic and they may feel like all hope is lost?
When you find yourself in that situation where you're talking to yourself and everything seems very bleak, I want you to remember that that is just a moment in time. It's just one moment. And if you have to tell yourself, you know what, I need to call it a day, and tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be okay tomorrow. My attitude is going to be okay and things are going to be different. It's a conscious choice, but that moment in time is when people make the decision of how they're going to handle their situation. And when it's looking pretty dire, you just have to remember, hey, this is just one moment and we're going to get through this.
Something my wife is named Carrie as well. And something that her and I speak to say to one another, we kind of have this mantra that we speak to one another, and it's to think with the eternal perspective. And I think that's a good way to phrase up what you just said. And, you know, even though something terrible happened to you, even though something that drastically altered the rest of your life, you don't have to be what that made you. You can rise up and you can be stronger. And I mean, if there's anybody who's a living testament to that, it is you. And I can sure tell you, you've made a difference in our lives down the road here. And we're happy to know you. Where can people find you online and on social media?
Online, my website is carrieportell.com. And, you know, there's a ton of information there. I have a blog. I have some videos, you know, to some of my presentations and contact. And then Facebook and Instagram are the main social medias. It's Carrie Portell, national speaker on Facebook. I am on Twitter. I just don't like Twitter very much. So I'm not very strong on that.
I'm not either. I don't know what it is about Twitter, but I just cannot get into it. Facebook is fine. Instagram's fine. Maybe I'm too old, and I don't know. Like, I don't think I'm too old for a lot, but I think I'm too old for Twitter. I don't know. It's weird. Like, you know, there's a lot of ag Twitter stuff, and there's like some people that get into it, but like, I don't know. It just seems like a lot of noise.
I think that's what my problem is too. Is there's a lot of noise. But there is a huge ag community on Twitter, and I don't know if just in our rural area, Twitter's just not the thing, you know, because Facebook has always been.
Yeah, because I am.
I just don't enjoy it, I guess.
I'm noticing, like, I noticed there's a lot of people from, like, the I states and from Nebraska, Kansas, you know. I don't know what it is. I don't know. I don't know if that means we're more.
A lot of crop farming, I know.
Yeah, a lot of crop farming going on. Not a lot of that going on down here in the Missouri Ozarks, so.
No.
Carrie, I really appreciate your time here today. This has been really fun because, like I said, you're really the first person I've got to talk to on this who I know personally, and it's been really a treat for me to even get to know more intimately your story, even though I'm somewhat familiar with it, to get to know it even better. So it's been really cool for me today.
Jason, thank you. You're the best.
Thank you. Thank you. That was our conversation with Carrie Portell. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes and to please leave us a review if you enjoyed what we're doing here today, and to take the time to possibly share this if this touched you in some way, and be sure to let somebody else know about it. And I'll see you the next time.
Thanks for listening to Ag State of Mind. We hope this episode has encouraged you. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Ag State of Mind. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify so you never miss an episode. See you next week.